Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is William Gibson, whose latest novel is Spook Country. Earlier novels include Pattern Recognition, going back to 1984, Neuromancer. William Gibson has been writing science fiction, but it seems like technological science fiction caught up past him, and the past couple of novels have been mainstream, taking place in the present or the recent past. In a recent interview, you talked about science fiction, in a sense, can no longer be predictive because technology is moving too fast.
That's not new for me. I had some sense of that in 1981 or even before when I was writing my earliest short fiction. But I came to the writing of science fiction with a newly minted degree in English literature. So I had some ideas about science fiction. One of them was that quite a lot of it, particularly in the United States, was hopelessly parochial and sort of pre-modern. And the other was that a lot of the practitioners didn't seem to realize that they weren't really writing about the future. They were writing about the present, and, you know, 5 or 10 or 20 years down the road, the only way to read their work critically would be to read it as though it was about the day in which it was written, because you can't read it as though it's about the future without considering the day in which it's been written. So I knew that. I had that as part of the pleasure of composition. I knew that every word I wrote, as I wrote it, was, as soon as it was in front of me, it was acquiring a fine patina of quaintness, because it was part of an imaginary future, and it was in the moment of its appearance that it had begun to diverge from what was actually going to happen.
And as you remarked in that interview, one thing you got right was globalization. You nailed that.
Yeah, I nailed that, so I gave the world globalization without cell phones. I mean, that's and that's the nature of nailing it when you're imagining the future. I've been afforded a lot of mileage for having envisioned the Internet, but I actually didn't envision the Internet. I envisioned something sort of like it. In Neuromancer, there's no porn. It's not the Internet. And I only realized yesterday, in having another conversation, that if YouTube had started while I was writing Pattern Recognition, it would have destroyed my novel, because the whole plot line of Pattern Recognition is totally pre-YouTube, because in the YouTube universe that we now live in, anybody who got this footage would put it up on YouTube, and it would be searchable and accessible to anybody, and people would be doing parodies of it. Pattern Recognition is a pre-YouTube novel, and anybody 15 years old who reads it is probably wondering what that means. Just like 12-year-olds reading Neuromancer, I figure they get 20 pages into it, and they go, okay, I get it. It's like 2035 or something, and something has happened to all the cell phones. That's the mystery here.
You've said that, you know, nobody could predict the future at this point because of that.
Yeah, but nobody could predict the future in 1935 or 1835. I mean, nobody's ever been able to predict the future. Our cultural conceit, which science fiction has, you know, always enjoyed furthering, is that science fiction can predict the future. But it actually doesn't, as we've just been saying. What it's actually good for, I find, is that it sort of gives me the oven mitts and the tweezers with which to pick up and interrogate an increasingly chaotic and often rather incomprehensible present.
William Gibson, let's talk a little about Spook Country here. You did decide to reuse one character, Hubert Big End, or however it's pronounced, who's this kind of spooky mogul. What made this, in a way, a continuation of Pattern Recognition?
Or as, you know, genre SF folks would say, set in the same universe. Initially, it wasn't set in, he wasn't set in the same universe, and Hubertus sort of forced himself on me, the way he's done before with my characters. He just kept popping up. It's like somebody forcing a card when they're, you know, here, you can pick a card, and you take the one, and I go, no, I don't want this guy. I don't want to do this again. he kept coming back, and maybe it's just laziness on my part, but he's so handy because he's so rich and he's so perverse and he's so off the wall, and he either is or isn't the biggest villain in the piece. That becomes a kind of metaphysical question, but I've always had the feeling with him that he was more Luciferian than satanic. He's sort of dangerous because he's too curious. It's like he's going to find out something that we don't want to know, but maybe we have to know. And then when I realized that his mother had been like a situationist girlfriend, then he started making a different kind of sense to me entirely. He knows there's a box, and he knows that people don't want him to know what's in the box, so he's going to find out what's in the box. If it takes creating a magazine in London to hire the one woman he knows that the one guy who might know what's in the box will be willing to sit down and talk to, then he'll do it. And he does it purely for the sake of satisfying his own curiosity, but then he's very good at making a lot of money with the byproducts of having satisfied his own curiosity.
You have three major characters. Hollis, who is the one woman who could get in to see the inventor, Bobby Chombo. Tito, who is a young Cuban involved in Santeria and almost a fantasy character. And Milgram, I'm not quite sure what Milgram is, except he's under the control of someone who may or may not be working for the CIA. Milgram's purpose seems to be to give us a sense of the real villain of the piece without actually going into the villain's head. Is that pretty much it?
Maybe. I might agree, but in an after the fact, in no way do I ever put these together in by sort of backing off with a chart and going, okay, I'm going to construct this character named Milgram, and he will represent this. I don't really do it that way at all. In fact, it's when I go out on the tour and have a whole lot of conversations like this one that I sort of arrive at some sort of narrative for myself about what it's about. But when I'm actually writing it, I'm not thinking about what it's about at all. In fact, if I let the what it's about conscious part of me in the room when I'm writing, it freaks out and starts crying and pretty much needs to be sedated. If I'm worrying about what it's about, it's like the super ego, and this is not good for getting the book done. So I actually don't know what these guys represent. They're the product of pretty much my subconscious, if I'm really doing my job. And I exercise a certain control over the tonality of the text, but if a book's really happening for me, I don't have much control over the characters at all. With this book, I was, into the last 100 pages of it before I knew what was in the box.
Really?
And I'd been like really, really worried. That had been the old superego was tearing its hair out over that one, because I kept coming up with different things that might be in the box, and none of them did it for me, and none of them were a suitable revelation. And when I realized what was in the box, I just thought, okay, no, this changes everything. So then I could go back and do what Bruce Sterling calls the backfill. I could go back to page one and adjust the tone, knowing what the reveal, as they would call it in Hollywood, was going to be. I only had to do a little bit of adjustment. But initially, I didn't know what Tito's family was up to. I didn't know what the old man was up to. I don't know. I say that, and I think some people don't even believe me. But that's how I work. That's how my big imagination works. If I get enough of that out where I could, the more conscious part of me can work on it too, I can get one of these books together. But 50% of the job is maneuvering myself into a position for months on end where I can sit down every day and try to do, even while I'm doing it, I persist in regarding as an impossible thing. The longer I do this, the less likely it feels to me that I can do it. It doesn't get easier. I've acquired a certain blind faith in the process. And my wife says that when I come out of the basement and declare that not only am I writing a really bad book, but I'm writing the worst book that anybody has ever written, she's always really happy because she knows we're like a month and a half or 2 months from turning in the manuscript.
William Gibson, the book starts with 3D virtual sculptures seen through glasses. Where did that come from? Did you have a specific sense of it, or did it just a...
Well, the idea's been around for ages, at least since the early 90s. And when virtual reality people and interface design people talk about this, they often call it blended reality. But blended reality is like such an unsexy thing, seems to me. I mean, it's kind of the opposite of cyberspace. Like, it doesn't make you want to run right out and buy one, right? It's just not good branding. So I went for locative or locative, actually. I'm never sure. I'm not sure how that's actually pronounced. I went for locative art. If you Google that, you get a bazillion hits. But most of them will be extremely academic and sort of conceptual arty and about mapping and Google Maps and what you can do with that stuff. But I knew about this blended reality idea, and people have done things somewhat like that. They would not that they've necessarily attached them to specific GPS coordinates, where they're attached to my book. But I wanted to take it, because I'd been put off by that sort of we're going to get tenure tone of the locative art websites, I wanted something that was like lowbrow and kind of like skateboard art. I wanted the equivalent that of Juxtapose magazine were writing about this kind of art, the kind of people they would find, not the kind of people you'd find if the Museum of Modern Art were doing it. So all of the locative art that I've made up in the book is kind of lowbrow.
It's more guerrilla art, actually.
Yeah.
Put the glasses on and you see something that you wouldn't see otherwise. But, of course, you know, that could easily be translated to walking into an empty room in a museum, putting on the glasses. You kind of have that at Bobby Chombo's place and suddenly seeing entire sculptures, a room filled with sculptures that you could only see by putting on the glasses.
Anybody, with this technology, anybody's going to be able to fill any museum with their work if somebody's got the right URL that day.
I kept thinking about the next technology in film, which will be in about 2 or 3 years, which is James Cameron's film Avatar, done in 3D digitally. I guess eventually you wouldn't even need a screen. You just look at the film, you know, with glasses, and you see a 3D film.
Yeah. The demo reel I saw years ago of what blended reality might look like was a sort of something vaguely akin to the Pillsbury Doughboy cavorting on some executive's desk. It wasn't that remarkable because it's the sort of thing you see in television commercials all the time. But if it was your desk and the thing was interacting with the real objects on your desk, that would be something else. That's doable. I've always taken it for granted with this stuff that interface design evolves toward transparency. So when I say glasses, I'm almost speaking in figurative terms. I doubt that people will actually need to be wearing glasses to do this stuff. There'll be other workarounds. It probably won't even be invasive. You probably won't even need to go into people's optic nerves because people won't be that keen on that, although they're certainly willing to have their corneas lasered. You know, everybody does that, so maybe I don't need to worry. But I think, just in some general sense, that as the characters in Spook, one of the characters in Spook Country says, cyberspace is everting. It's turning itself inside out into the non-cyberspace space and colonizing it and taking it over. And that's just what's happening, if that's what's happening. There's nothing really we can do about it. I mean, we've gotten to a point now where I was talking to someone the other day. They were talking about technology, and I brought up television. And then they said, yeah, but there's television, but then technology. And I said, wait a minute, you're speaking as though television is part of the natural world. And they said, you know, you're right. Like, that television is given, kind of like apples or horses. And it's all technology.
You know, my mother is online, and she's 83 years old.
Well, that's because it's evolving. That's because it's all evolving toward transparency. There's no longer any learning curve involved in doing email. You know, when you're not on dial-up anymore, you forget what dial-up was like. And if you find yourself back on dial-up, you're going, ooh, this is impossible. It takes, like, forever to do anything. How did I ever do this? Well, you didn't notice it before because that was where you were, and now you've moved on. It's evolved toward transparency and speediness.
You're listening to an interview with William Gibson, whose latest novel is Spook Country. Someone on the Node magazine online site, Node magazine is the fictional non-magazine of your book, Spook Country, mentioned that you kind of created the use of iPods to smuggle data. And I kept thinking, so we have flash drives?
No, you know, I actually didn't. I'd heard about people doing that or the possibility of people doing that back when the iPod was a new technology. I liked it just because I liked the iPods visually. I liked the idea of these smooth white things in this sort of the landscape of the book. And a friend of mine said, you know, they wouldn't be using iPods. They'd be using those $14.95 made-in-China digital cameras, keychain. She said they'd be using $14.95 keychain cameras. She said you should use those instead. And I said, well, it's a good tip, but I can't use those because they're not resonant in the same way. Like, the iPod is culturally resonant in a bunch of ways that worked for me when I was writing the text. And cultural resonance trumps technological accuracy or technological realism every time.
3 years had passed between finishing Pattern Recognition. So it took time to write Spook Country. Was there ever a case where, as you were writing it, you found that the earlier, I don't want to call them drafts because it's in your computer, but earlier stuff suddenly was out of date? Did that occur at all?
No, although the draft that was published as the advanced reading copy, the draft that's out now as the hardcover, differ specifically in that in the advanced reading copy, I didn't know that you can't receive GPS signals indoors. And I only found that out just before the book was about to go to press, so I had to do a marathon straight through revision to try to catch all of those points. And if Cory Doctorow hadn't told me that, I'd be out with this book that is just kind of, even for me, kind of embarrassing tech flub. Center stage. But he also provided a fix, and he said when you want to do it indoors, you work with a computer program that triangulates off the three nearest cell phone towers. So you create a kind of mini GPS grid within the building.
William Gibson, obviously there's more to life than technology. 9/11 plays a role in both of these books and how the world has changed. You have one character make an interesting comment, a character named Inchmail. He says that he thought that America had developed Stockholm Syndrome toward its own government. Is this an idea that you've come up with?
It's an idea that Inchmail came up with. I need the lens of Inchmail in order to arrive at his dialogue. You have to trust me on that one, because if I were doing it the other way around, I would be being a didactic novelist. And that's something I've never wanted to be. Like, I don't create Inchmail. Actually, creates, like, I don't even like the word create, but I don't create an Inchmail to say my editorial piece. It's like I invoke these characters and give them a considerable degree of freedom, and they become, in some ways, able to say things, able to think and say things that I would be hesitant to say.
You'd need proof, whereas they can just say them.
Yeah, they can just say them. It's like I had a very similar question the other day about Tito's cousin Alejandro saying that the United States is in a state of what he called cold civil war. And the interviewer said, oh, my God, do you believe this? And I said, well, that's not really the question. The question is whether or not this Cuban-Chinese character who was trained by the KGB in Havana and necessarily has, as does anyone who grew up in a Marxist country, has, like, being a criminologist is his primary mode of political apprehension. So when he looks at politics in America, he's looking at it as a criminologist, as a Sovietologist. And if you do it that way, how does it look? That's where I want people to go with it. I don't want people to believe what they might think I believe. I want them to ask themselves questions. That's a much more satisfying function. It's just to cause people to ask themselves questions. In a way, when I'm doing an interview, I'm short-circuiting the thing I've got set up to perform my preferred function because I kind of volunteer to answer questions about the text.
Most of which, I guess, can't really be answered by you because they're coming from an unconscious place.
Yeah. I actually think to the extent that it's any good, they're coming from an unconscious place. Like the part of me that drives around and buys bagels and gets the car washed, the contributions of that part to a book like this are extremely minimal.
William Gibson, you appeared and we were interviewed a little bit about this book on Second Life.
Yes.
And for those who don't know, what is Second Life and how did you get into it?
Second Life is a large online 3D, I guess, VR construct built with its interiority built by participants. And the participants are volunteers who enjoy doing this, and they go there and assume avatar form. So they assume a sort of anime cartoony form, which they've tweaked and created themselves. And they interact with one another and have really quite a kind of astonishingly large-scale economy now. A lot of it's about shopping for virtual stuff for your avatar, and a lot of it's about virtual real estate, which the Linden Labs, the company that runs Second Life, can always make more real estate. So it's the opposite of what your real estate agent tells you when she says, well, you know, it's location, location, and location. They're just not making any more of it. Well, it's not true in Second Life. Location's not very important because they can always make more of it.
Had you had any contact with it before they interviewed you?
I'd known about it, but I hadn't had any firsthand experience of it until someone at Penguin Books in London, who is someone, they have someone who's their Second Life guy in the office. He was really keen on me doing this. So somewhere back in, I think in December, I sat down one night and went to their site and created an account. And my avatar emerged on the Learning Island, I think it's called, where you first, the beginner's territory, where you first appear when you're all new. The first thing I had to deal with was I was a girl. Some default in their software had interpreted the first name I had chosen when I chose my two character names from a list that they provide. You can't really make up your own. As female. So I had this, like, female avatar, and I was like, whoa, strange. So I began with this instantaneous transgendering and switched myself back to a male form, and then had to decide what I was going to look like and what I was going to wear. And then I went out and walked around and found it just very, very strange. Everywhere I went, there was never anybody there. There were one or two people in these huge areas. And I gather from what I saw when I did my reading that primarily it's a place for social interaction, and if you don't have a network of friends, you're going to be very lonely. So you're either going to have to find a way to create a network of friends, or you're going to have to go there with a posse in the first place, which I think a lot of people do.
When you were interviewed, or when you gave your little speech there, you made an interesting comment about the future of books, saying that you could have a book, one object, I guess you could download different books into the object.
Yeah.
That makes sense. You know, one thing I was thinking about is that for years, virtual online bookstores or record stores won't work because we like to browse. But that's not true anymore. There's Amazon, there's Netflix. Browsing has disappeared.
Well, browsing, in a way, is what eBay is about for certain things. I mean, you have the option on eBay of using, like, their search engines to quickly find something you're looking for.
But you have to know what you're looking for.
Yeah, you have to know what you're looking for. But if you don't know what you're looking for and you're determined to get it, and eBay really is where you're going to get it these days, be it an old record or an old book or a piece of jewelry or some collectible thing, you have to create a syntax of increasingly vague search terms that start randomizing what you're looking at. When you get really adroit at that, I know some people have gotten really adroit at that for certain things, it's just amazing what they can turn up. Like, you get one guy out of 10 can find something that's really valuable in the course of a few hours clicking through the stuff that the other 9 people can't ever find, even if you tell them it's there. Yeah, I dare you to find this. I just found this. It's up. I can't find it.
William Gibson, all of the technology, should that make us more paranoid?
Well, I don't think so necessarily. I mean, one of the things that I always found kind of strange about doing interviews about my work is that, like, people would assume that I was a dystopian, or they'd refer to, say, Neuromancer as dystopian. Dystopian is really relative. Like, if you live in Lagos today, you'd immigrate to Neuromancer, like, in 3 split seconds, and you'd be better off. I mean, dystopian kind of depends on where you're living. There are places on Earth today that are beyond dystopia. You know, they're just kind of almost, everybody's almost dead, and that's the world today. By the same token, I've been, some people, depending on which way you look at the Nexus search in the old days, in the pre-Google days, I was either a Luddite or a radical technophile. But where I've always very consciously tried to stay is absolutely neutral, agnostic. I have to be agnostic about technology. I actually don't think that technology is moral. I mean, the machine gun, good or bad? Probably mostly bad, but it's hard to say. There may be moments in which machine guns can serve some morally acceptable function, or nuclear bombs, as in Freeman Dyson's plan to drive starships by exploding nuclear bombs behind them in space and get to Alpha Centauri by using up all those potentially bad news nuclear bombs. So I think where technology becomes good or evil is when human beings use it for something.
But paranoia, I mean, human beings using that kind of technology, the kind of technology you discuss in Spook Country, being able to pinpoint people, pinpoint everything. I mean, there's no place where Hollis Henry cannot be found by Big N. That could be pretty scary, particularly if put in the hands of, say, the Bush government.
Yeah, but so can anything else. The same technology means that if she's, afloat on a life raft in the South Pacific, she's far more likely to be found as long as she has a transponder. It means that nobody's ever away. It's a matter of what you do with it. And I think that the forces in the world that would look at this technology and see it as a ready-made template for permanent Orwellian oppression, I don't think they're very smart. I mean, really, that's the problem anyway, is that they're not very smart. And they don't see the other implications surrounding that technology. And one is that it's really not possible anymore to keep secrets, not for very long. Like any politician, I did an op-ed piece for the New York Times on Orwell's centenary a couple of years ago, and I was talking about this, and I said, you know, if you're a politician out there and you're doing something and, you know, your whole career depends on nobody ever finding out, I said, forget it. They're going to find out. They're going to find out. They're just going to find out. Like there's an inherent transparency and porosity to this whole thing. Like the termites are going to get you. Somewhere down the road, they're going, oh, okay, I see what you did. And it's going to be on YouTube.
One way that I've seen that happen the past few years is that the right-wing liars who would just make stuff up and get away with it, people like Rush Limbaugh, can't do it anymore quite as well because immediately going online, you'll find the truth and you can publicize it.
Yeah, although the sad thing is to say they do keep doing it. They do keep doing it, and it almost seems to me they do it harder, the pedal closer to the metal, to try to get the last little bit of viability they can out of addressing the part of their audience that would never go on the Internet to find out what they really said. It doesn't completely pull the sting, but, you know, I remember in my high school there was a saying that bull baffles brains. It was about how to write an exam if you had no idea what was going on. And there's really some truth to it in the short run. But in the long run, there's not. It catches up with them. When it's 2 or 3 years old and it's stale, it's really obviously bull.
William Gibson, you're a Canadian. How do you look at the U.S. now?
I don't know if I'm a Canadian. I mean, I feel like a guy from Southwest Virginia who lives in Vancouver. And one of the things about Canadianness is it doesn't have such rigid descriptors. I don't think that the way I look at the United States differs that much from the way other people of my ilk, whatever that might be, look at the United States. And, you know, I tend to be like, you know, kind of on par with what most of my friends are down here are thinking. And I don't see, there's not that much difference. It does give you kind of having led an expatriate's life, that probably does give you kind of an extra degree of perspective, I guess. It's like, I get it now. It took me a long time, but I can sort of get it when I see non-American people reacting to the United States with, like, cynicism or some degree of resentment. It's like, okay, I get that now. Like, I think I maybe get it in a slightly different way than I would if I'd stayed here. And it's not that I necessarily agree with those people, but it's that I can see where they're coming from.
William Gibson, now you've written Spook Country. Obviously, it's a little bit too soon for you to have started another book. Do you see yourself continuing writing books set in the present? Do you see yourself moving into the past at all?
I don't know. I never know until I start. I'm a method writer. I'm at the mercy of my process. And I know, like, for the last couple of years, I've read really, really a lot of American history, particularly a lot of stuff about the Civil War and the period immediately after the Civil War. I have no idea why I'm doing it. I've just been compelled to do it. My mother had a collection of county histories from Southwest Virginia. These are these privately printed histories that Judge so-and-so of Abingdon wrote, mainly to glorify his own ancestors and his race. And my mother had like a 3-foot shelf of these things. They're all like big bug-crushing books. And I sat down a couple of years ago and read them all very carefully and put little slips of paper in them. I don't know why, but, you know, I look at that and I go, maybe I'm going to write a historical novel. I mean, somehow the particular toolkit I've arrived at in the course of my career doesn't seem to me to be limited in terms of its application. The end result becomes more interesting to me if I try to stretch and use those same tools on material that I wouldn't have considered before.
You've been listening to an interview with William Gibson, whose latest novel is Spook Country. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.